I'm John Kroll. We have a special treat on today's No Limits. We're going to talk with Guy Raz, the host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. We're going to talk about what makes the show tick and ask him to take us inside it. We're going to talk about his favorite moments doing it and what he has learned from it. Please join the conversation. Please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI. You will want to be part of this, so please give us a call or drop us a line. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We've got a treat for you today. Our guest is Guy Raz, who is the host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. Guy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation, and they can do so by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, you're in town, obviously, for an appearance tonight. Is this your first time in Indianapolis?
You know, I was here before. I have a friend who lives here. I probably won't see him on this visit, but I was here for a wedding 15 years ago. So I'm sure the city has changed quite a bit since I was last here.
Just a bit. Okay. Yeah. So you were here last time, though, was entirely in a personal and private capacity rather than, you know, talking to an audience of, what, a couple thousand of your closest friends tonight. I want to talk a little bit, get started. I'm always fascinated by what brings people to do this kind of work.
Yeah.
You know, what leads people to journalism to, you know, as we were talking before we went on the air, I said, to thinking, okay, I'm going to make my living by asking nosy and often intrusive questions and trying to push people to reveal more than they might be comfortable with. What started you on that path?
You know, I was a student journalist, so I was a journalist in high school. I worked for the student paper and in college. And that actually, in practical terms, doesn't really matter. And I say this to journalism, to college students, that if you aren't doing journalism in college, it's fine. I didn't study journalism. I studied history. But what I found about journalism and the reason why – I mean, there are a variety of reasons people go into it. You want to make a contribution to the world. You want to see history unfold. You want to be there. You want to actually experience that event. But really, in a very practical reason, I found journalism to be this world-changing experience because I, you know, even though I have a program now that is listened to by millions of people every week, and I do a lot of public appearances, I am I'm naturally introverted, which means that, you know, if I go to a party, I tend to, you know, to sort of hang out with one person the entire evening. And I was never the kind of person who could just walk up to somebody who I didn't know and make friends with them quickly and easily. I always felt awkward doing it. But give me a microphone, and it's like giving, you know, giving a mere mortal a cape that then turns them into...
So it liberated you.
It liberated me. It let me walk. It gave me a license to walk up to anybody, and ask them any question because I was doing it not for me, not for personal gain, but for this higher cause, this bigger, greater purpose. And all of a sudden, it opened up a world to me that was restricted, that was limited. You know, once I had a notepad when I was a student journalist, or a microphone when I became a radio journalist, it was like I could talk to anybody, you know.
And that anticipates my, you know, my next question is, why radio? You know, there when you do this kind of work, there are all sorts of paths you can take. What led you to radio?
Well, it was very fortuitous. You know, I came to NPR as an intern in 1997.
Okay.
And I was an intern on All Things Considered. And I came to NPR because I just thought it was great. I did not grow up in a house that listened to NPR. My parents are immigrants, and we didn't listen to public radio at all. We listened to commercial radio, Ken and Bob in Los Angeles and Southern California. But I discovered public radio on my own in college. I stumbled upon a documentary that was by a guy named Dave Isay, who many of your listeners will know as the guy behind StoryCorps.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful documentary. I'd never heard anything like it. And I said, I need to find out more about what this thing is. And after college, I applied to NPR to be an intern, and I got it. And I started my career there. I never thought that I would become a radio reporter. Even at that point, I still thought I would be a print reporter, and I did a lot of print writing. I wrote for the Washington City Paper, which is the local alternative weekly in Washington, and I wrote for the Washington Post and a few other publications, and still thought I would become a print journalist because in the late 90s, the only game in town, if you wanted to be a serious reporter, was print.
Mm-hmm.
Public radio really grew, NPR really grew very quickly in the last decade to become this sort of huge, powerful, and consequential news organization. But even in the late 90s, it was still seen as a sleepier place.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really just out of love for listening to it, and then by getting a chance to actually work there, I ended up by chance in radio. And God, how lucky was I that happened.
What was the appeal once you were there? I mean, as you say, you were on a different kind of path. I'm trying to get at what is it about this medium that seems to liberate you even more than another one might have?
You know, John, it's something that I think I've had a chance to reflect on over the years, because often what happens is when you are in the middle of experiencing something, you're not quite sure why you are affected by it. But over the years, I have thought about this a lot. And I think there is something about the human voice that connects with people in a way that is different from, you know, watching somebody move. Like if I'm speaking to a group of people in public, I am communicating to them in thousands of different ways, in the language I use, in my body language, in my micro expressions, just movements of my face and my hands. And that is mainly how humans interpret, you know, what another person is like. But the voice also has thousands of micro expressions, cadence, speed, pauses, silence. And when you just have the voice, there is something really powerful about how you connect with another person. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Her. It came out a few years ago, Spike Jonze movie. And it's about this guy, it's played by Joaquin Phoenix, who falls in love with a voice. He wears a Bluetooth device and he falls in love with a voice. The voice is Scarlett Johansson. And it's totally plausible because they have this intimate, loving connection, and he's just listening to her. And I think there's something about the voice that connects with people on the radio, you know, that connects with people. And that's what kind of brings them to what we do.
Gotten an email from a listener named Kathy. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Kathy says, curious as to how being with, listening to, and opening to the new ideas that show up in the TED Radio Hour has changed your life. That's a big question, Kathy. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's a really important question because in every single way is the answer. I mean, I was in the news part of NPR for most of my career. And when I left to start the TED Radio Hour, I had been hosting All Things Considered. Mm-hmm. And many of my colleagues thought I was crazy for doing this, for leaving the news side of NPR to go and start this unknown show with TED, this organization that is not NPR, not a news organization. And many people, I mean, famous people that you would have heard of, my colleagues, who said, you are crazy. And I thought maybe I was too.
Mm-hmm.
But I was at a point in my career where I wanted to be part of the solution and part of encouraging a conversation around ideas that could give people a sense of possibility. News is important. We need news. We need to know what's going on in the world. But news is difficult. News is depressing. News is divisive. People have different views of the same topic. We also draw from different pools, well, different wells of fact. You know, you look at a big issue like the Benghazi hearings that are happening today, or the Planned Parenthood controversy. People on different sides of that issue are not drawing from the same pool of fact. So I wanted
is it,
to—
Is it that, do you think, or is it, you know, that, I mean, in some ways the classic spirit of inquiry is, okay, we're just going to approach this and try to figure out what has happened or what this is about.
Yeah.
Increasingly in our world, it strikes me that people approach information from a point of conviction and say, okay, I'm only going to look for the facts
exactly,
that support my...
And that's actually, and that's a, and you've clarified exactly what, I, what I'm saying in a better way of saying it, which is that people have a viewpoint, and if they are, if they need to use facts to support their viewpoint, the facts already support their viewpoint. And so we're living in a very divided time, not just in our country, but around the world. I experienced that as a journalist living overseas. And I really, you know, we talk about how we talk about all these geographic divisions and racial divisions and cultural and religious divisions around the world. And I thought, you know, 98% of our DNA is identical. Okay. And I know this may sound somewhat naive, but I believed it then and believe it more firmly now, having done this show for 3 years, which is we are the, you know, we are a basically an advanced primate. You know, we're the only hominin of, you know, species on planet Earth, the only species of our kind on planet Earth. You know, there are many different kinds of whales and dogs and, you know, cats. There's only one kind of hominin, and it's us. And so I was really interested in doing a show about what it means to be human and how we experience the same things, whether you live in a, you know, an impoverished village in East Asia or in a high rise in Hong Kong or New York City. We all experience the same things. We all experience jealousy and love and rage. We all have the capacity to be violent or creative. We all die. We all experience grief. We all, you know, we all have to figure out how to organize ourselves as a species. So this is what the show is. And those are the ideas that have really kind of, you know, they become my jam for the last 3 years, you know, that, that actually I care about the world. I care about the news. I care about the differences that we have as well. But I'm really interested in also thinking about this very common thing that we are. And that's why, and that's really that's really had a huge impact, you know, on the way I see the world and the way I see my job.
Was it difficult for you to leave the news side? I mean, you say people were telling you that you were crazy to do this, and I understand your motive. In some ways, you were talking about finding new ways to communicate ideas and stories and all of that. But that is the world you came up in, and I can tell just from talking to you, you are a natural reporter. You're more, far more comfortable asking questions than anything else. Was it difficult to leave that behind?
You know, it was initially. I mean, I still can remember very vividly the feeling and the excitement of the evening Bin Laden was killed, and I was live on air for 3 hours. Or, you know, or being the live anchor for, you know, an election night, 2012, incredibly exciting, and I loved that. But I can tell you, John, that in my 15 years doing news and in my 3 years doing the TED Radio Hour, the response that we have received from our listeners through personal letters, emails, tweets, calls that I get, voicemails that I get, it's mind-blowing. I mean, I will tell you, and you may not believe it because I can barely believe it, but people quite literally write, this show's changed my life. I can't believe that, that I am involved in something that is that powerful, you know, for people and is really inspiring them in ways that I never felt when I covered the news.
What's the most, I want to circle back to Kathy's question real quickly here. What's the most important way it's changed your life?
It's made me more optimistic. And I think more compassionate.
And how does that manifest? How did it do that? I mean, is it just you've...
Well, I think that I you know, by interviewing a variety of people around one idea, I have come to understand that the world isn't about about issues. It's not about what's happening today or yesterday, but it's about much, much bigger things that we don't entirely understand, but in some ways are more meaningful. You know, I am more animated by having a conversation with five different people about what love means or what it means to be compassionate than, you know, whether the Speaker of the House is going to be somebody who Democrats can work with or can't work with.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Guy Raz, the host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Guy Raz, the host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, we were talking about your start in news, and I want to sort of wrap that up before we talk about the TED phenomenon, which your show is part of, and I don't know whether it helped create the wave or surfs it or, you know, what the metaphor would be there, but I do want to talk about that. But we have pulled a clip from one of your early stories about the group The Doors. Could you talk a little bit about that story?
Yes. This was done 15 years ago, or maybe 16 years ago. And it was a series NPR did called the NPR 100, the 100 greatest pieces of music from the 20th century. And I think just two or three of them were actually rock and roll songs. One was Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. One was The Doors' Light My Fire. And I interviewed all the surviving Doors. For that, everyone except Jim Morrison, Ray Manzarek, and Robbie Krieger, John Densmore. I interviewed all three of them for a story that I believe was, you know, 8 or 9 minutes or 10 minutes. And it will be – I have not heard this in many years. So it'll be fun to hear my voice from that time because I think at that time I was still early in my career and I was trying to sound like Captain Radio because I was still, you know, a bit sort of self-conscious about my voice. So that is the setup, and hopefully we'll hear
We've got I think about a minute and a half of it, so we'll play that now.
Couched between the north and south end of L.A.'s surf beaches is Venice. By 1965, it was long abandoned by the body-worshipping surf set. Venice was a new world beach of beat poetry, where the Jewish pensioners who gathered in front of the synagogues mingled with the mystical hippies on the boardwalk. A place where four artists, each one ready to express his own musical sensibility, came together as The Doors to make their psychedelic rock the sound of Los Angeles.
We were aware of Muddy Waters. We were aware of Howlin' Wolf and John Coltrane and Miles Davis, plus Jan and Dean and the Beach Boys and the surf sound. Robbie Krieger brings in some flamenco guitar. I bring in a little bit of classical music along with the blues and jazz, and certainly John Densmore was heavy into jazz, and Jim brings in beatnik poetry and French symbolist poetry, and that's the blend of The Doors. As the sun is setting into the Pacific Ocean, at the end, the terminus of Western civilization, that's the end of it. Western civilization ends here in California at Venice Beach. So we stood there inventing a new world on psychedelics.
You know, the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide. Break on through to the other side.
That was an early story from our guest, Guy Raz. about the Doors for NPR, and you know, while we were playing that snippet, you were shaking your head. What were you hearing? I mean, you said you hadn't heard it for years.
I would be lying if I didn't say it's a little painful for me to hear now. As a critic of my and like you, John, I teach journalism at George Washington University, and so I would work with that reporter very carefully to have them redo that in a way that was less stilted. But, you know, the cool thing is it was a – you know, I feel so lucky to have worked at NPR at a time where we were not as big because I think had that gone out on the air today, and I don't think it would have in that shape, you know, you would just be pilloried on Twitter and social media. And I think now – you know, I think then there was more space for a younger reporter to make mistakes and to kind of sound a little dopey. But what was really cool about that
– You're being a little harsh with yourself.
Well, yeah, I probably am. What was really cool about that story was we really got inside how that song was written and the feeling of that time. And it was a song that I always liked, but I didn't realize how significant it was. It was actually based entirely on John Coltrane's version of My Favorite Things. Do 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 do. So that song was a really significant piece of American music.
You said before we went to it that, you know, you were still trying to use your Captain Radio voice and all of that and working through it, and you talked about how it sounds stilted to you and all of that. How long did it take you? And I say this, I was nodding my head when you were saying that, because if you do this, particularly if you weren't trained in it or at the beginning, it takes you a little while to learn to relax into just talking at some level.
It does, yeah. And you know, I think for a long time I thought that I had to be taken seriously and to be considered a serious journalist, because I was very young when I went overseas. I was 25 and I was nervous, and I thought, and I looked young, so I thought people wouldn't take me seriously. So I thought to be legitimate or to be taken seriously, I had to sound like Robert Siegel or, you know, Bob Edwards. And that took me a while to figure out that I didn't have to do that. That, you know, I could sound like me, and I still kind of think, you know, I will meet people now who will say, "I love your voice." Somebody tweeted the other day that said, "You know, listening to Guy Raz's voice is my, you know, my anxiety medication every day." And I thought, my God, you know, my own voice in my head is my anxiety inducer every day. So some people really love my voice. Some people hate it. I'm sort of, you know, I've gotten used to it now after, you know, living with it for 40 years. But it took a while. It took some time. And even the TED Radio Hour sound different than I did when I hosted Weekend All Things Considered, because it is a more playful show, and it's a show that's more intimate, and we're not doing serious news, the serious news. And I think people have an expectation of what the serious news should sound like.
Yeah.
But I think that's changing. I really do. I think that's changing very quickly, and I think a lot of younger voices on NPR are leading that charge.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Guy Raz, the host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. He's here in Indianapolis for an appearance. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Gabe, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mr. Raz. It's great to hear your voice live on our local station. As somebody who's listened to more TED Talks possibly than anyone else, I wonder if you have an idea of what a recipe is for a good TED Talk.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Gabe.
Yeah, thanks for listening to the show. I hesitate to give the answer to that, because I think a lot of people think, well, a great TED Talk has to have a compelling personal narrative, you know, a moment, a turning point, you know, resolution, like the hero's journey, you know, like you know the hero begins reluctantly, they're pushed into battle, they go into battle, they hit a crucible, you know, they emerge heroically, come back and bring the potion to the village. and I think there's some TED Talks that are like that are amazing, and there are some TED Talks that have no personal story, just an idea in them and no real, you know, no story necessarily, but they still move you, or they still there's something about them, about that story, about that talk that is really, really compelling. I mean, we, you know, I'll just give you one example. There was a guy named Jorge Soto who gave a TED talk at TED Global in 2014. And his English is good. It's not great. He's from Mexico. And he's an engineer. And his TED talk was about this incredible discovery or this process that his team is working on to basically diagnose cancer through a blood test, right? And they have been very successful in identifying pancreatic cancer and certain other cancers so far. It's still in the testing phase, but that talk blew me away. You know, he had a little bit of a story in there about his aunt and how she died and how it was diagnosed late. But the main idea in his talk was that the silver bullet for winning the war, if you will, on cancer is not right now curing cancer. It is detecting it very early. We know that by detecting it very early, we increase the chances that people will live a long life. And that was a talk that had a huge impact on me. I love Amy Cuddy's talk, which has a personal story. It's one of the most viewed TED Talks of all time. You may remember the power pose, because she does make herself vulnerable on stage. And I think that, to me, what I love are the talks where people, you know, people are willing to kind of make themselves a bit vulnerable and kind of open up in a sense, at least even to admit being nervous on the TED stage. So to me, the key is there has to be an idea in there. There has to be an idea that the person wants to get out into the world.
I've gotten a related question from a listener named Abby who didn't want to go on the air. Says, have you done your own TED Talk? Or if not, would you be interested in doing your own TED Talk? And what would it be about?
You know, I have been asked to give TEDx talks, and I do events at TED when I go to the main conference in Vancouver. You know, there are a lot of sort of strings of things swirling around in my head, but nothing that I am ready to fully kind of develop yet. I mean, I would love to talk about fear, what it means to be fearful. I mean, or courage to me is a really interesting idea, because I did things that would be perceived as courageous in my life. You know, I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan mm-hmm. and in Iraq and in the Middle East, and was shot at many times and detained and, you know, very close to big bomb blasts. But but if you ask me if I think of myself as a courageous person, I would say no. And in fact, I have constant anxiety just about being a parent. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I know that they're perfectly safe. But, you know, I am constantly in fear that you know, that something could go wrong. You know, it's an irrational feeling, as I think a lot of parents have about their kids. But
is that because, you know, you make decisions about your own safety, and
yeah.
you can accept those, and to some degree you can control those.
Yes, right.
It's much harder to do that with your children.
Totally, yeah. Totally. You know, we had this weird thing with my son once. I went, dropped him off at school, and a very strange alarm went off at the school, which was the lockdown alarm. Now, it was tripped accidentally, but it was a lockdown alarm. And you could see the anxiety and the look in the teacher's face, because she got all the kids, and the kids didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And she gathered them into the cubby area, and you could just feel it was very tense. And I happened to be in the room at the time dropping my son off, so I was locked in. And I just thought to myself, what if this is real? You know,
yeah.
There was a moment when I was really scared. I thought, my God, my kid's in here. You know, so I'm interested in the idea of courage. I'm interested in the idea of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness is a really interesting, important subject that I think needs to be mined more. It can be incredibly liberating. I've experienced it, mm-hmm. And I think it's just an amazingly powerful tool in the arsenal of human, you know, human behaviors or experiences.
When you said that you left news to do, you know, the TED Radio Hour, you said you wanted to be part of the solution. What problem were you trying to solve, And, you know, in what way did the show represent the solution to that problem, or a solution to that problem?
So I really should say a path to the solution, because I don't think the solution is there. I mean, humans are very complicated. We have big problems. But I'm interested in creating a space for people to think about the possibilities out there, you know, and how we can think about organizing ourselves in a way that is positive and productive. You know, we have a show that we're doing this weekend that you can hear on this station on Saturday and Wednesdays, I believe, that is called Open Source. Now, most people hear that term open source and they think, oh, computers and technology.
Yeah.
And that's really how it began. It began with Linux, and actually the World Wide Web was open sourced. And basically what it means is that the people who are developing ideas have decided not to be proprietary, that they are putting everything that they have come up with out of their brain and putting it out there online for anybody to see, the blueprints, whatever it is. But increasingly, the open source philosophy and principles are moving to other parts of the world, outside of technology, into things like open source, you know, democracy, you know, where there are experiments in allowing people to, you know, to constantly contact their representative and to tell the representative how to vote on a specific issue. There are experiments in open source architecture. You know, so it's a – we are living in a time where, you know, where we can exchange ideas so easily and so readily. But we're also living at a time where there's a lot of conflict and war and division and hatred. And that is – so when I say that I want it to be part of the world that thinks about the possibilities, that's exactly what I mean. You know, by reporting on the news, which is very important. It's I'm a news junkie. But I felt like I could make a bigger contribution to the world as somebody who could create conversations and convene conversations around ideas and possibilities and start the sort of the gears turning in the minds of our listeners about what, you know, what could be a solution to something.
We've gotten a question from a listener who did not want to go on the air, wanted to ask about the direction, the leadership at NPR right now. It's focusing more on old-fashioned radio. Do you feel the new leadership feels the necessity of embracing digital? You know, basically, where are we going in this world right now?
No, that's a great question, and I think that there is for people who follow this, I should be very careful. So, for people who sort of follow the inside discussions and conversations around media and especially public media, there is there is the reality that the radio you and I are speaking through now, terrestrial radio, FM radio, you know, in 50 or 60 years, probably nobody will be listening to the radio, but they will be listening to you and me in a different way through some kind of digital platform.
50, 60 years from now, they won't be listening to me.
But, but they'll be listening to audio. Humans will always listen to audio. Audio is like video or a print or a photo. It's a way for people to get information. So I do think that actually that NPR is very committed to a digital future. But radio is still important. It's the vast majority of our audience. You know, I do a show in which most of our listeners are digital listeners. About 14 million people download the show every month, so we have a huge digital audience. But radio is still important, and we still connect with people, especially people who, you know, are not as tuned into the digital side. So to the listener who wrote the question, keep listening. Check out. I mean, you will see a lot more digital content coming out of NPR in the future, and I think a robust commitment to that digital future.
Does it change the way you tell stories? I mean, the fact that radio's power used to be just its immediacy, that we were talking and that's it. You said it and it's gone.
Yeah. I mean, our show is a radio show. We are on the radio. So with us, it's a little bit different, which is that we serve two audiences, the digital audience and the radio audience. We are lucky that we don't have to worry about the immediacy. Our shows are generally evergreen. I would say with what we do know, I do tend to think about the digital audience now and again, you know, with certain decisions we make, but by and large, not really.
We are talking with Guy Raz, the host of NPR's TED Radio Hour here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Guy Raz, the host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, we've talked about the move to the TED Radio Hour. I have to ask, I mean, I don't think I have ever seen a phenomenon quite like the TED Talks explode in my lifetime. When did you first kind of become aware of them and think that this might be something big and certainly something worth, you know, altering your career path for?
I actually first encountered TED Talks in like probably 2010, 2011 maybe. I was not somebody who knew about it much. I didn't. I wasn't a huge consumer of. I wasn't a consumer at all of TED Talks. I liken I remember when I went to become the host of the show. Somebody quite literally said to me, "This is in 2013. I feel like the TED thing is over," and I laugh about that now because I think right now, TED is where Starbucks was in 1990. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you think it's exploded, you know, in a major way, just wait, because it is still, I mean, it is going to become much, much, much bigger. And I think the reason why is because as we are living in a world in which we connect to each other through digital devices, the TED system, and especially the TEDx system. So TEDx, as most of your listeners will know, are these independently organized TED-like events that just happened in Indianapolis, TEDx Indianapolis. They are licensed by TED, but they're not run or curated by TED. TED does one conference a year, mm-hmm. which is in Vancouver. But TEDx's happen every day around the world. And I think that as we become more connected digitally, people want to reconnect, you know, on a human-to-human level. Mm-hmm. They want to be around people and exchange ideas and communicate with them and hear them and argue with them and laugh and do all of those things with other people. You know, back in, you know, in the day, people would join, you know, social clubs. Mm-hmm. People would join, you know, Kiwanis or, you know, the Scottish Rites or the Masons or whatever. And now we know that increasingly, you know, people aren't joining these things anymore as much.
Is it almost – I mean, it's always struck me when we talk about the TED phenomenon as if it is an updating of like the Chautauquas.
Yeah, totally.
You know, that there is this idea that, okay, we're going to get together and we're going to throw what wisdom we have into a pot.
Socrates and the Agora. I mean, like, way back.
Yeah, and so there is something, despite the sort of cutting edge, something that is almost retro about the whole thing, too.
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, it's you know, it is the Oxford Union or the, you know, the Roman Senate or the U.S. Congress, but it's not just for a small group of people. It's for anybody. First of all, you know, TEDx conferences can be mounted by anybody anywhere mm-hmm. in the world. The TED event itself is, of course, a little bit different. It's quite expensive to go, mm-hmm. but all of those talks are made available for free online. So all of their content is essentially opened up, is made mm-hmm. available to anybody to use and to watch in any way they choose. And I think that the fact that you know, people are hungry for ideas and for possibility also speaks to the TED phenomenon. You know, we are living through a very complicated time, and I'm not saying this to mm-hmm. be pessimistic. I'm not at all. I'm incredibly optimistic, but But we are living in an age where information is available to us in so many different ways, and it's unsettling. You know, I liken it to this: the age we now live in is more significant than the Gutenberg age, more unsettling, because the barrier to entry is been eliminated, and everybody can amplify their voice. And I think that creates a lot of noise, and it's hard to find the signal. And I think TED has become that signal for many people.
In terms of putting together your show, I mean, as you say, there is a lot of content there, and you've got an hour. You know, how do you decide how you're going to organize it? What you're going to focus on or do?
Well, it's a combination. I mean, there's really no kind of scientific process. It's part of it is if there's a great talk that I like, I will hold on to it, and I will look for themes in that talk. And then I will try to find other talks that might fit with those themes. There are just themes that I want to do, and I will gather a variety of different talks to try and figure out whether that theme will work. We're working on a show now about anxiety, so an interesting topic that I'm
interested as you said, in. You're passionate about in some way,
and it looks at depression and mental health in general. You know, you go to the doctor when you're feeling ill, but you can we can diagnose you with a blood test, but you can't really. It's very the way you diagnose mental health is through a questionnaire. So we're still, you know, it's still a different way of looking at you know being ill, and so we're kind of exploring that. So one example of a show we did recently was a show called Finite. And the way that show came about was I had a running injury. I actually fell and you know, I just sort of ignored it. And the injury eventually became infected, and I didn't really notice it until it began to travel up my leg.
Uh-huh.
And I woke up one morning unable to move my leg. Uh-huh. And I had and the infection got so bad I had to get a sonogram. They were wondering whether it was a blood clot, and they figured out it was an infection. They put me on an antibiotic, which did not work, and there was concern for a 24-hour period that maybe it was a resistant strain. Eventually, I did get an antibiotic that worked, and it was fine. But it led me to think about this idea that, you know, we can create an infinite number of antibiotics, but their effectiveness is finite. So we ended up doing a show about things that are finite, including antibiotics.
How many of those shows come out of – I mean, it sounds like there are two right now. I mean, the show about anxiety, obviously you got a personal interest there. The Finite one, it springs from a personal experience you had. How much of the show is because you get to explore areas that you just happen to be curious about?
A lot. I mean, a lot of it is. You know, we did a show about growing up, about what it means to, you know what identity means. I'm really interested in identity because it's something that I've always kind of spent a lot of time thinking about. So a lot of our episodes are, you know, compassion, are related to things that I want to explore further because I have experienced it in either a positive or in a negative way in my life. So to be perfectly honest with you, the show is in some ways a form of therapy for me as well. But I hope that people don't, I do everything I can so that's not evident that it's really designed to be a show that anybody can connect with.
Is that I mean, you say you do everything you can so it's not evident, but would it be that bad if it was evident? Because some of what we're seeing these days is that there does seem to be a hunger for more personal forms of journalism. You know, the old myth that we were like this, you know, this filter or whatever, that the news flowed through.
Yeah.
When anyone with a brain could realize, okay, it is a human being telling me this story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we do, I do talk about, you know, we did a show about love. And there was a moment in there. And sometimes I do talk about my own life, my children. My wife, and we did a show about fear. I talked about my fear, exactly what I just told you about the fears that I have as a father, the anxiety I have as a father, just wanting my kids to be safe. You know, on our show about love and about how one of the guests was talking about how the things we expect out of our partners are very different from the purpose our partners served, you know, over the course of human history. Like now we expect our partners to be, you know, not just our you know, our spouses who, you know, who help us, you know, create children, but also our lovers, our best friends, our, you know, the person we're around all the time, the person we seek advice for. It's a different kind of way of interacting, and it's new. It's a phenomenon that's only been around for about 100 years less. So, you know, I talk about my own experiences and bring them up in the show pretty regularly, and I don't. I try not to be egregious about it. I don't want the show to be a self-indulgent exercise. I want it to be something that people experience as their own thing. But I agree that it's important to let myself into the show and show something of who I am, because I think people, you know, people connect with it in a more intimate and more personal way when they trust me and they know me as well.
I got a question from a listener. Says, what does Guy think of internet-based news organizations like BuzzFeed, Mashable, et cetera?
I read BuzzFeed a lot. I think they do some really good stuff. I think they pioneered, obviously, the listicle, the, you know, 21 you know, places to get a greasy burger at 2 in the morning in Indianapolis. You know, they do some very good, serious journalism as well. I think they're really great. I mean, I think that there's a lot of they are these organizations have really pushed the limits of what journalism means, and they have helped to change it. You know, they've helped to bring about a different kind of storytelling, and also they've brought in new voices. You know, people used to talk about Tom Wolfe or Hunter Thompson as these guys who really changed journalism in their day, and then in the 80s, there was a lot of talk about people like P.J. O'Rourke and Michael Lewis. And, you know, I think now the voices that are changing the kind of journalism that we all do and we all should be doing are coming through some of these internet news organizations. Some, not all the journalism is great. Some of it's really not good. But a lot of it is very good and very, very interesting.
What makes for you a great TED Radio Hour and, you know, what are the ones that don't work? And I mean, I know you probably do not want to talk, but even here, we have shows I know when I step away, okay, that wasn't what I hoped it would be.
Yeah. I think that the shows that work best are shows that have a combination of social science, physical science, that in which there is a narrative arc, and we are taken on a journey through an idea. So there was a kids television show. It's still, I think, on video now or DVD. It's called The Magic School Bus. And it was Miss Frizzle who used to take the kids on a journey and often through the human body. That is how I like to think of the show, that you get on this bus and we're going to go on a journey through an idea. So the idea might be time. Or it might be screens. You know, what are we becoming? But over the course of that journey, we're dipping in and out of narratives, experiences people have with this idea. That to me is a perfect show where you've got a combination of the hard sciences, the soft sciences, personal, you know, narratives. We have people who aren't necessarily experts in the field, but have something to say. You know, we in our cancer show, which was a really uplifting show, actually. One of the most wonderful conversations wasn't with a scientist doing groundbreaking work. We did have those conversations, but with a woman named Deborah Jarvis, who's an ordained minister and a cancer survivor, and talks about cancer as an surviving cancer as an identity, and an identity that she has decided to reject. And she does it with humor and also with a lot of compassion, and it's. That to me is when we really, you know, achieve our the purpose of what we're trying to do.
What are the ones that don't work?
You know, I think shows that where we're really careful about this, shows that are issues focused, you know, shows that tend to deal with the here and now, We don't do too many of them. We have occasionally touched on topics that I'm interested in that I think are really important, but that maybe are too tied to a specific thing happening in the world. So we try to be careful to make these shows timeless. You know, and occasionally, you know, we have a great idea. We have a great talk in there or two, but not all of the talks are exactly as we like them to be. And we go ahead with the show and it's good. I mean, we have an amazing production team, so we will not put a bad show on the air. But, you know, our best shows are the best work we've ever done. And our worst shows are still good shows, but, you know, we sort of feel like they could be a little better.
Getting a tweet from a listener named Roxana says, WFYI has bees and a green roof. Do you ever visit the bees at NPR News?
In fact, that's a great question. I sit just down the corridor from the bees at NPR. We have a green roof. We have bees at NPR. The honey is harvested by a beekeeper in Washington, D.C., I think twice a year. And I believe he just did a harvest. So I didn't see that happen, but I do see the beehives, yes.
What do you see as the sort of the future? Because a lot of these questions and a lot of our conversation has been about sort of the evolving nature of communication, of storytelling. I mean, where do you see all of this going? That's sort of, I'm encouraging you to sum up here in about the 90 seconds we have left.
It's hard to know. I mean, it's really hard to know. I know this. Humans can absorb information in two ways. Well, more or less in two ways, through our eyes and through our ears. Of course, we can get information through our smell and through touch and taste. But really, the information that we assimilate and we use every day, we get through our eyes and our ears, that is never going to change. It has never changed. It's mm-hmm. just the physiology of human beings. So people talk about the collapse of journalism or the collapse of this industry or that industry. It's the collapse of a certain platform, the printed newspaper, you know, the television set, mm-hmm. the, you know, the radio signal, not the radio station, not the mm-hmm. newspaper organization. We're just going to call it something different mm-hmm. because humans will always have a need for information. So, you know, the challenge that we will face and the way we will absorb and assimilate information, if I could answer that question, you know, I would be working at Apple and probably, you know, making billions of dollars. But I'm convinced that smart humans will figure out the answer to that question.
And do you have any ambitions beyond TED Radio Hour? Is this something you could see yourself doing for quite a while?
You know, I think I can see myself doing it for a while. I love the show. It's a lot of fun. I'm sure down the road I'll probably try something else. Every sort of few years I try something else at NPR, and it's been incredibly fun and gratifying.
Well, it's been a lot of fun and been gratifying to have you here with us. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
We will be back next Tuesday when we are going to focus our attention on Indianapolis's mayor's race. As most people know, we're going to have a new mayor in this city one way or the other come January. So we're going to focus our attention on that important race. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.